Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. This is the first of our shows for year number four. So thank you for being listeners to The Outspoken Cyclist. We will give you 50 new shows in the 2013-2014 season. I hope you are enjoying all of them. Tomorrow is also the first day of September. It's Labor Day weekend here in the States. And for many of us, this is the psychological end of summer and the beginning of our fall cycling season. Of course, it's almost time for cyclocross, too. And tonight we're going to talk about one of the biggest cyclocross festivals in the U.S., Providence. The festival runs the weekend of October 5th and 6th, although there is a lot going on the night before October 4th, and we'll talk about that. It's considered the anchor event of what has been affectionately dubbed Holy Week on the East Coast. Clark Smeltzer is the press officer of the Providence Cyclocross Fest and has a lot to tell us about the broad and deep weekend of riding, racing, eating, drinking, and fun. Clark will join me in a moment. So let me ask you a question. Do you live in a strong town? In the second half of the show, we will answer that question with Chuck Marone. Chuck is a civil engineer, or more accurately, is a civil engineer who has decided to turn civil engineering on its head. Sarah Goodyear's article for the Atlantic City's online site titled "What Happens When a Town Puts People Before Cars" quotes Chuck as saying, "Taking highway standards and applying them to urban and suburban streets and even county roads costs us thousands of lives every year. There is no earthly reason why an engineer would ever design a 14-foot lane for a city block, and yet we do it continuously. Why?" We'll ask him that question in the second half of the show. I'd also like to let you know that next week there will be no on-air broadcast of the show as we're being preempted by John Carroll Football. So we are uploading our podcast an hour early instead, and the podcast will be available at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time instead of 6:30. So let's mosey on over to Providence, Rhode Island, and talk with Clark Smeltzer, press officer for the Providence Cyclocross Festival. Clark, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Cross season's right around the corner. Here we are. I want to talk about the Providence Cyclocross Fest. You're the press officer. Let's start with the dates, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty of the amazingly large-scale event that it is.
Sure. Sounds good. Yeah, the Providence Cyclocross Festival will be happening October 4th through 6th, 2013, in Providence, Rhode Island. The majority of the events will be taking place at Roger Williams Park. The races, the Grand Fondo Industry Expo. But we also have events on Friday before the event starts, before the racing starts, at the Providence Biltmore. That includes the Bike Walk Summit and the Builders Ball. And like both of those Friday night at the Providence Biltmore.
So let's talk a little bit about the Friday night events, and then we'll get into, let's just do it day by day. So there's a Builders Ball. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Builders Ball is great. It's an opportunity to see sort of all of the bicycle artistry that we have here on the East Coast. You know, the East Coast has got an extremely rich heritage of bicycle frame building, you know, going back to the 19th century. But then, you know, more recently, there's just been sort of a slew of artisanal builders, you know, working in the area. People who have learned from the builders who came before. There's a great genealogy of frame builders, and what we do at the Builders Ball is showcase the artistry of, you know, sort of the builders who are working in the East Coast. We've got, you know, a couple of builders from Providence who will be on hand. We've got Circle A Cycles, Chapman Cycles, Dharma Cycles. And it's interesting, if you look at those three builders, you know, all three located in Providence, but all three working in, you know, three entirely different of genres of bike building. Circle A working with steel and sort of a more traditional, but they also built custom bikes, but, you know, traditional hand-built steel bikes, racing-oriented. Chapman Cycles, which is more sort of old-school style frame building, lugged steel frames. Then Dharma Cycles, you know, which also works in steel. So, you know, a bit of the traditional builders, but then we've also got people on hand like the Hartford Bicycle Studio, which is doing interesting things, taking refurbished bikes, but adding a twist in that they're working with local artists to sort of produce a custom piece of art, you know, a bicycle, but a bicycle that's been painted by, you know, an artist from the Hartford community. So, you know, you not only have the utility of the bicycle, but you have the, you know, artistic side of the expressive side of the bicycle as well built in.
Nice.
It's a fantastic opportunity. You know, there's just so much talent. It's if you like bikes and, you know, you want to see just some really nice hand-built bike frames and components, that sort of thing, you know, the Builder's Ball definitely is a place to be. And it's a fundraiser for the East Coast Greenway Alliance, suggested $3 donation at the door. Be a great time.
Okay, so we have the Builder's Ball, we have the Alliance, and then what else is happening on Friday night? This is all at the Biltmore, which is a hotel, obviously.
This is at the Providence Biltmore.
Yep, right.
It's
okay.
It's the official race hotel.
Okay.
Builder's Ball is Friday evening. Friday during the day, we're going to have the Bike Walk Summit, sponsored by the East Coast Greenway Alliance. It's going to be a gathering of advocates, panels discussing fundraising, urban design. It's just basically a place for everybody to gather, exchange ideas. And, you know, the nice thing about having it in conjunction with the Providence Cyclocross Festival is that, you know, we have the industry on hand, obviously, since we have, you know, a massive expo
right
at the event. And then with all the racers, like, it's a great synergy, you know, to bring the advocates to meet with the industry, to meet with the athletes. It doesn't happen as often as it should. We're very excited to have, you know, all three of those components of cycling together, for the weekend. You know, it's a powerful alliance.
It's interesting you say that. A couple of years ago at the Bike Summit in Washington, D.C., there was a breakout session that actually brought that together. It was industry, professional cycling, and then advocacy and how the racers could actually help to promote cycling outside of the, you know, professional racing part of the circuit.
That's really become something that more racers have begun to get involved in. We've got Tim Johnson's Ride on Washington.
Right, right.
Sponsored by Bikes Belong. Jeremy Powers took part in that as well, you know, both of whom will be racing. Tim Johnson and Jeremy Powers, you know, will both be racing in Providence. It's definitely, you know, definitely something that's picking up, and, you know, we're very excited to be a part of that.
So then, Friday, what happens Saturday? When does actual cross racing begin? Is it on Saturday that you start your races?
The racing begins on Saturday.
Okay.
Yeah, there is some racing on Friday. We do have two events on Friday,
okay,
which are new for this year. We've got a UCI Elite Junior race.
Nice.
Which is, it's pretty fantastic. Yeah, we're very excited about that. It's the only UCI Junior event on the calendar that weekend. So we do expect to get a good turnout for that. Not only that, but we've got a $2,000 prize purse for the juniors, which is pretty unheard of, you know, at that level.
So who's sponsoring? I mean, who actually is putting up money and sponsoring? And, this is a big deal. This sounds way different from what we think of, from quote-unquote local cross racing. I mean, we have a cross race series here, but nothing like that.
Yeah, well, we've been very lucky. One of the organizers, Patrick Gogan, I believe, one of his acquaintances was kind enough to, you know, put up the prize money for the juniors. So it is unusual, and it's the first time that we've been able to, you know, one, host that sort of event, and two, you know, put up that type of purse. So definitely cool. An exciting development.
So I have a question, just to move us a little bit in a different direction. Why is the Providence Cyclocross Fest part of, it's the anchor of what they're calling Holy Week? What is Holy Week?
That's correct. Well, the term Holy Week comes from road cycling.
Okay.
It's the week that starts with the Tour of Flanders and ends with Paris-Roubaix.
Right.
So two of the bigger Belgian classics. And, you know, we've got similar situation with the racing that we have, you know, here in New England, where we have the Great Brewers Grand Prix on the weekend preceding the Providence Cyclocross Festival. Great Brewers Grand Prix, also a UCI Category 1 event. There's a Category 2 event on Sunday. And then the following weekend, we have the Providence Cyclocross Festival, which, once again, a UCI Category 1 event on Saturday, and then a Category 2 event on Sunday. So you've got two Category 1 events within, you know, 100 miles of one another, two Category 2 events on the next day. So it's an opportunity for people to, you know, come to the events, and there's the possibility to gain, you know, a whole bunch of points in a short period of time with very little travel involved. So it allows us to really sort of bring talent that, you know, might not have otherwise traveled for, you know, an individual Category 1 race. Like I said, being able to offer two races of the, you know, of that stature within a week of each other and within 100 miles, it really is just, it's a huge draw. So
that's pretty cool.
That's great. Yeah. And so, yeah. Like I said, we sort of co-opted the term Holy Week. You know,
it's our American American version of it.
Exactly. It's the Holy Week of cyclocross.
Yeah, I like
just
it.
Just to differentiate it from the Holy Week of road cycling.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's very cool. So you're also going to have an expo. How many people will be exhibiting, and what kind of things could people see at the expo?
Yeah, the expo, we're really excited this year. We've got Jim Wanamaker, who's come on. He's call him the hardest working man in cycling. Just been a real gift. As of right now, we've got about 40 companies signed on to for our expo. We have space for up to 80. And, you know, we certainly plan on adding, you know, more exhibitors as the, you know, as the event approaches.
Right.
Pretty much anything you can imagine. You know, if you're looking for new bikes, you know, we'll have bike, you know, all the manufacturers are going to be there. Any sort of aftermarket components that you're looking to, looking to get, we're going to have, you know, component manufacturers. Naturally, all of our sponsors will be exhibiting, Whole Foods, Cal Giant Berry, Raleigh, certainly. You know, so basically anything cycling-related that you can imagine, chances are there will be an exhibitor there who will have what you are looking for.
I'm talking with Clark Smeltzer. He's the press officer for the Providence Cyclocross Fest coming up October 4th through 6th in Providence, Rhode Island. I'm actually thinking of going out and attending this year. So we'll see if maybe we can actually meet face to face. That would be kind of fun. Okay, we got to talk about food. I mean, let's really talk about what cyclists love. We ride to eat or eat to ride. I don't know which. Talk to me about the food. Nobody's going to go hungry or thirsty, it looks like.
They will not. No, absolutely not. We've, you know, we're going to have some of the best food trucks from Providence on hand. We'll have Mijo's Tacos. There'll be barbecue. We'll have our friends from La Strada Wood-Fired Pizzeria on hand. They're based out of Brooklyn. We'll have the Harpoon Beer Tent, you know, so once you grab your food, you can take it to the Harpoon Beer Tent, sit down, grab a brew. Beer tent conveniently located right next to a set of barriers, so you won't have to miss any entertainment while you're refueling.
That's awesome.
And that's great. And the beer tent is really the place to be. You know, putting it right next to the barriers, you might think that it would be sort of a dangerous thing to do, but, you know, it really is like, it's one of the most wild places to be on the course. You know, people giving, you know, dollar bill hand-ups to the riders. You know, some of the races you'll see people offering beer hand-ups, whether they take it, obviously, you know, up to the cyclist, but it's a great atmosphere. It's very, very festive.
Sounds like a 10-ring circus, actually.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So if you're not there, are you going to have any kind of coverage? Are you going to be filming any of it? Are you going to be, you know, videotaping it? Is it going to be on TV? You know, we're starting to see more and more cycling being watched, especially in the States.
Yeah, we will be. We'll be working with Cycling Dirt. We worked with them last year for the first time. We had a live stream of the event. And
cool.
We actually garnered the largest audience for a U.S. cyclocross race broadcast. So, you know, it was definitely a good first year experience, and we expect this year to be that much bigger.
Cool.
So, like I said, there will be a live stream. You know, the link to the live stream will be up on the webpage, and around when, as that approaches. But yeah, definitely look for the Cycling Dirt live stream.
Okay. And then the last thing I want to talk about is the Gran Fondo. They are getting much more popular. They're kind of an all come and sign up. What's the Gran Fondo? Where's it going? Who can participate?
Sure. Well, the Gran Fondo is open to anyone.
Okay.
And if you're not familiar with the Gran Fondo, it's a mass start ride. They are timed. So there is a bit of a competition facet involved with it. You don't have to compete, certainly, but, you do have the opportunity to, sort of go out for time. There'll be three different lengths offered. There's a short route that's about 27 miles that'll be staying entirely within Rhode Island. There's a middle distance, which will be about 64 miles, which will dip into Connecticut and then back into Rhode Island and then back to Providence. And then there's the long distance ride, which is 103 miles, which goes into Connecticut into Massachusetts and then takes riders back down south and then back into Providence. And we'll be having Jake Keogh, who will be our ride ambassador. He's a professional cyclist with United Healthcare, won the 10th stage in the Tour of Portugal this year. So sort of a breakout international win for him. He's been, known on the domestic circuit for quite a while, but, really sort of having a breakout season internationally. And we're working with the Keogh brothers on a couple of other projects that we have in conjunction with the Cyclocross Festival, which I would actually like to touch on a bit later. It's going to be a great event. It is the first year that we'll be having the Gran Fondo in conjunction with the Cyclocross Festival. So, we've got modest goals for the first year, but we do have, we've got some sort of surprise guests that we're working on. So definitely keep an eye out for more announcements regarding the Gran Fondo. We are working on some pretty cool stuff. So
cool.
Definitely excited about that.
Well, I think the other thing we want to talk about is the Divine Youth Initiative.
That was exactly what I was hoping
to get
to. Yeah.
Okay. That was new to me today. What is that?
It's great. It's a really awesome program. It's organized. Patricia Dowd is in charge of the Divine Youth Program. And what it is that we're working together with the Keogh Cyclocross team, which is, recognize the name from Jake Keogh, who's the ride ambassador for the Gran Fondo. And the Keogh family is a family of three brothers, all of whom race professionally. And they and the Little Bellas mentoring program, which was founded by Leah and Sabra Davison, siblings. So both of the people that we're working with in the Divine Youth Program are sibling groups, the Keogh brothers, and then the Davison sisters with the Little Bellas program. And what they'll be doing is they'll be visiting schools in Providence, introducing kids to cycling. We'll have, professional races on hand, sort of explaining the ins and outs of the sport. And then they'll have the opportunity to try it out at Roger Williams Park on Friday afternoon. We'll have kids there. There'll be bikes available. The YMCA is donating helmets for kids to use. Whole Foods is donating sponsorships for the Little Bellas program for kids who might not be able to otherwise afford it. And basically, like I said, it gets kids outside, shows them what's possible on a bike, that you can have fun and, it's not as dangerous as you might think it is, and hey, playing in dirt is healthy.
Yeah. I think so.
Better's the immune system. So, it's just nice. It's a great program, and we really have a lot of high hopes for it. So, and it's just it's exciting to work with a group of people who are so excited to get their message out there. The Keoghs and the Davison sisters, their energy is it's catching.
Well, that's cool. I can't even begin to wrap my mind around all of the things that are happening at the Cyclocross Fest all at once. It's just like, this is enormous. How you're going to cram all this into 3 days, I have no idea. Do tell our listeners how to get information on the Providence Cyclocross Fest.
Sure. Well, you can visit us at providencecrossfest.com.
Okay.
And we have all of the all of our press releases are up there. Links to registering for the race. If you want to register for any of the clinics that we're offering, if you want to register for the Gran Fondo, register for any of the races. That can be all done at bikeredge.com.
Well, Clark, this is amazing. I hope we do get out to Providence to see this whole thing and do our own little, you know, maybe spot interviews. That's kind of what we're thinking. I was talking to Richard about that. And I would just really wish you guys a lot of luck. You've got a lot on your hands. I'm going to let you get back to what you're doing. Thank you for joining me on the show this evening.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right. You have a wonderful night.
I will.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Clark Smeltzer joined me from his offices in Rhode Island to talk about the Providence Cyclocross Festival. Sounds like a really good time. Certainly not going to be hurting for eating and drinking. And that beer tent sounds like a cool place to be. If you're in the Providence, Rhode Island area, you might want to stop by and take a gander at some of the things that are going on. What's going on in news is what's next here on The Outspoken Cyclist. We haven't talked much about what is happening in the San Francisco area recently, so today we actually have two items of interest. The first is that the San Francisco Bike Share program launched this past week. In a cheeky post to the San Francisco Streets blog site, editor Aaron Bialik headlined his piece about its launch this way: "At long last, bike sharing stations have begrimed San Francisco," referring back to the besmirching comments made by Dorothy Rabinowitz, the board member of the Wall Street Journal, a couple of months ago about the Citibank bike share program in New York City. Anyway, the new Bay Area bike share actually covers five cities from downtown San Francisco to San Jose, and there seems to be some concern that the program might be held back by what is seen as a sparse number of bikes per station. So we'll keep watching what's going on in San Francisco. The second story is just plain ugly and disturbing to me. A young woman cyclist was killed by a hit-and-run driver, and the police totally dropped the ball. The San Francisco Bicycle Coalition decided to pick up the case, and here's what they posted. Quote, "The San Francisco Bicycle Coalition has discovered evidence that the San Francisco Police Department may not have fully and fairly investigated last week's fatal crash where 24-year-old Amelie Lemulac was hit and killed while biking to work. The San Francisco Police Department had claimed that they had asked nearby businesses for video footage and found none. We now know that is not true." So while police claim that they talked with nearby businesses, evidently coalition members walked into no less than five businesses in the area and found that none were asked about the accident at all. Then the coalition program manager, Mark Caswell, found actual footage of the crash from a nearby surveillance camera. There seems to be a lot more to the story, and there is a formal complaint filed against a police sergeant for his disregard of other cyclists' safety while trying to blame the victim of the crash. So I'm going to continue to follow this story. It just seems like it makes no sense as to why a policeman would not want to investigate this and then harass other cyclists, you know, while they were asking questions. So probably one of the most passed around stories this week comes out of Canada, where Kayla Smith foiled a thief when she stole her own bike back from him. The story was reported in a lot of places. This is the text from Grind Media. A woman in Vancouver whose bike was stolen discovered someone was selling it on Craigslist and went about stealing the bike back in a hilarious tale she shared on Facebook and Reddit. Kayla Smith had her bike stolen from a friend's house last Wednesday and posted on Facebook, quote, "that I was disappointed and sad because I had worked so hard for the bike. I absolutely love, love, love my bike. So needless to say, I was choked." She called police to report the theft and phoned the bike shop to retrieve the bike's serial numbers. And an hour later, a friend called her and said, "Dude, I think I found your bike on Craigslist." Smith recognized her bike in the post and called police again, but was told it might be another day before an officer could get back to her. "This guy is selling my bike right now," Smith explained. "I am not missing this opportunity waiting for a call. So I jump into action." Smith made arrangements to meet the seller at a McDonald's. "When I pulled into the parking lot, I still had no plan of attack," she said. "I got there and saw the guy with my bike. He was wearing board shorts, a raggedy tank top, and dark, sketchy glasses. I noticed that it was my bike right away because of the ride-on stickers on the frame and the fact that I have a silver handlebar plug on the left and a black one on the right. Here is where I started thinking on my feet." Smith asked the guy if she could take a test ride around the parking lot. Yeah, just don't ride away, the man told her. Of course, I'm like, don't you worry, I won't, she relates, and then I just ride away. Classic. To be honest, I was shaking and freaking out, she said. I couldn't believe what the heck just happened. When Smith met up with a friend in another parking lot, she was giddy with excitement, jumping up and down like a six-year-old getting an ice cream cone. The thief was last seen running away from the scene. The serial numbers did match the bike, incidentally. And after that, Smith said, I called him and personally left him a message apologizing for not sticking around to pay him for the bike he freaking stole from me. Canadian police urge people not to take matters such as these into their own hands, but in this instance, it all worked out okay, hysterically so. So it's a pretty funny story. I think it's awesome. There's a picture of her just grinning from ear to ear holding her bike. It's really, really cute. We hear about the NBA draft and the NFL draft and baseball trades all the time. Well, there seems that there is no lock on the transferring of athletes as it's time to play pro biker shuffle. Here's a portion of an article from roadcycling.com. Some teams have no big surprises. Case in point, Chris Froome is still a Team Sky member. A little bit of a surprise is Bradley Wiggins will continue to wear the black and blue of Sky in 2014. A larger surprise is that Wiggins has thrown his arms up and resigned himself to defeat in regards to racing the Tour de France. And the article goes on to talk about some of the other riders and how the system works. So if you would like to see that, it is roadcycling.com. And the last article I'd like to talk about is about depression, actually. And I know that many, many people suffer from varying degrees of depression. Pro athletes are not immune to it, evidently. This month's Bicycling Magazine features a really candid and amazing article by pro racer Jillian Carlton about her struggles with the often debilitating symptoms of depression. Titled Ending the Silence, here is an excruciatingly raw and honest excerpt from the piece. Quote, I am done with living like this. I cannot be a good teammate, a good athlete, a good daughter, a good girlfriend when my head and my heart and my lungs and my legs are begging so desperately for a break. For years, I have been able to keep my frantic anxiety and mania at bay with cigarettes, with alcohol, with antidepressants and sleeping pills, with cuts that get bigger and more numerous on my arms and legs. But now I am scared of what might happen if I stay silent any longer. Stopping and taking a deep breath and saying there is something wrong with me and I need help to fix it is incredibly difficult. But I am saying it. I am taking a hiatus from the rest of this road season and starting a mental health treatment program in my hometown. I want to thank every single one of my teammates and all the amazing staff and sponsors of Team Specialized Lululemon for being so incredibly supportive of this decision. I am doing everything I can to be ready for this upcoming track season. I want more than anything to be there on the podium at the World Cups, at the World Championships, at the 2014 Commonwealth Games. But at the end of the day, it is just bike racing, and I need to learn how to take care of myself first. I don't need to tell you how valuable this could be. Jillian is a brave lady, and you can read the entire piece online at bicycling.com. Finally, this is actually a bit of local news, and it was sent to me by Anna Meyer, who is the programming and research assistant at the campus district here. She has asked me to please let you know that the near east side of Cleveland needs better connections to the lake, and let's move together to plan a change. The Campus District Incorporated, Greater Cleveland YMCA, Cleveland Urban Design Collaborative, and Bike Cleveland invite you to the East Side Walk and Ride, fun guided tours designed to gather your insights on barriers to pedestrian and bike connectivity in the campus district. Follow along on a guided walking tour or bring your bike and join the ride. It is scheduled for Tuesday, September 3rd from 8 to 10 p.m. You're to meet at the southwest corner of Euclid Avenue and East 22nd Street near Cleveland State University. There will be a route for walking and one for biking, so choose whichever you are most comfortable with. If you're biking, please bring head and taillights for your bike. So that's the story. There is an RSVP available on Facebook, or you can get a hold of Anna at info@campusdistrict.org. So that is our news. We are moving on. We're going to take a quick break on the Outspoken Cyclist, and I'll be right back, and we're going to talk about strong towns with Chuck Marone.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
I'm Drew Brees, and being a dad means the world to me. And one of the most important things any parent can do is make sure their kids get active at least 60 minutes each day. Studies show that physical activity not only helps kids stay healthy, it can enhance important skills like concentration and problem solving, which can improve academic performance. This means physical activity can help your kids in the most important game of all, life. Learn more at fitness.gov.
Brought to you by HHS.
We are back on the Outspoken Cyclist, and we're going to head right on over to Plainfield, Minnesota, and talk with engineer Chuck Marone about strong towns. Chuck, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I learned about you and your work from an article by Sarah Goodyear for the Atlantic Cities Online. The title of the article, What Happens When a Town Puts People Before Cars, you say that your work, your profession, has gotten it all wrong when it comes to building cities and towns, and that just sparked my interest. Also, having spent the last 15 years with an engineer, I was interested in your article, Confessions of a Recovering Engineer. So can we begin at the beginning, and you can tell us a little bit about yourself and your work up until you had this revelation about what you were doing?
Sure. I got an undergraduate degree in civil engineering back in 1995. Wow. And worked then for half a dozen years as an engineer. I worked a little bit at MnDOT, the DOT here in Minnesota. I worked at a private consulting firm doing municipal style engineering, sewer and water extensions, road, street projects, that type of thing. And I went back to college after half a dozen years to get a urban planning degree. I'm not saying I was a bad engineer, but, you know, an engineer is like, there's a certain kind of your brain that does engineering. And I was not the facts and figures and data number crunching kind of engineer. I was really more of I found myself kind of navigating to the project management side of things. And that requires kind of a bigger picture mind. And I just thought that I was lacking some skills. There were a lot of things that I didn't grasp and didn't understand that I thought would be augmented by having that urban planning degree. So I went back to school, and that really kind of changed things dramatically. I mean, you really are exercising a very different part of your intellect when you get a planning degree than an engineering degree. And wound up just through this process kind of questioning a number of the things that were just core assumptions for me as an engineer. I worked for a number of years then running my own planning company here in Minnesota, working with small towns and medium-sized cities around the state, doing engineering, planning, kind of integrated type of work. In 2008, I started a blog that became the Strong Towns blog, and the article you're speaking about, I published about a year in, after I'd had a week of just frustrating conversations with both engineers and planners about a number of projects. And I sat down, and in the course of really about 45 minutes, it was a pretty quick piece, just kind of poured out the things that I was most frustrated about with the profession that I was a part of. That is the most widely read piece on our blog ever. It's been downloaded, you know, a couple hundred thousand times at least.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's, you know, I've seen it show up in different books. I've seen it show up in college prep material for different courses. And so I'm really proud of the fact that this kind of, I think the major insight of the article was that when engineers look at things and evaluate space, they're starting with a different set of assumptions than what the public does. And even though the engineering profession and the public are saying the same words, the words mean different things. When an engineer looks at a street and they talk about safety, they're actually saying something quite different than what you and I would think when we think safety.
Hmm.
They're saying, well, given the design speed, the speed at which the traffic must travel, And given the volume that is projected for this specific street, how do we design the safest street possible? And once we do that, how do we then make it affordable? How do we reduce costs as much as we can? That's a very logical approach to an engineer. When the public looks at a street and they think safety, the first thing they think is, how do we have safety over everything else? And once we have a safe street, how do we make it affordable and cost-effective? Once we have it safe and cost-effective, how much traffic can we accommodate and at what speed? And it is a reversal of what just the standard engineering kind of siloed approach is. And it has had a fundamental impact on, you know, negative impact on the way we've built and designed our cities.
Well, you do say that roadway standards have been adopted almost universally and are utterly shameful in reality. So tell us what the actual thinking on the engineering, civil engineering side is in terms of the how streets have been built up till now.
Yes, the engineering profession is full of really good people, and I've met really nothing but conscientious, decent people who believe they're doing the best for society.
Of course.
But if you go back to the early highway building days, we had no clue what we were doing. I mean, the traffic engineering profession is very young. We went out and started building highways, and all of a sudden, all these people were dying in these terrible accidents. And we stepped back, and we asked ourselves some difficult questions. And we realized that when we didn't build highways straight and wide and have wide shoulders and wide recovery zones, people got in accidents and they died. And we came up with this concept called forgiving design. The idea is that you forgive the driver for their mistake. If they accidentally look in the back seat to check on their kid, or they look down to change the radio station and they happen to drift a little bit, you don't want that to be a fatal accident. You want them to have the ability to recover from that. And so we started to build highways with forgiving design standards. And the federal government, which was managing a lot of the funding, still is, set up these standards that states then adapted and adopted locally. And what you had was a proliferation of safety enhancement as it related to highways. The problem is... twofold. One, there was no, for many, many decades, there was no equivalent standard at the local level. And so engineers would apply what they saw worked in other places, which is essentially highway standards, to local streets. The second problem, which is even a little bit more insidious, is that a lot of the local streets were funded by federal dollars, and still are, federal and state dollars coming through the gas tax fund. And when those dollars are allocated, in order to ensure that it's a good investment, there's standards that go with that. In Minnesota, they're called state aid standards. They're different, have different monikers around the country. But essentially, it is highway-level design standards that are forced on local units of government. There's people underway and engineers working within the profession that are trying to change this. The Institute of Traffic Engineers has done some really good work, but it is an uphill battle because every city around the country has kind of dogmatically, as part of instituting these programs over the years, put into place highway standards for local streets. And we literally have to go in, take all of those out, and change them out. And from a professional liability standpoint, it freaks engineers out. From a, you know, kind of turning your back and acknowledging that maybe what you've done the last two or three decades has not been the best is a really challenging thing from just a humility standpoint. So we've got a big task in front of us to change the profession so that we can start building better places.
So if we look at what the standards have been till now, and it's wide streets, clear sight lines, a higher speed. The obvious other way of looking at it is, I read what you said, trees, people want trees in their yard, so don't cut down the trees. They want narrower streets. They want slower speeds. And we've taken some of the beauty out of driving through your city. And you've got a lot of stuff. I need to tell people, first of all, that we're speaking with Chuck Marone, and he is the head of an organization called strongtowns.org. And it's a fascinating website if you really want some information. What have we said about cycling so far? Nothing, but you're going to see how it all ties in as we get further down the road here, so to speak. So let's talk about strong towns. Your revelation that these old standards weren't going to work in today's world if we wanted people to live in communities that we want to live in, assuming that we do, don't any longer work. What is a strong town? What exactly are you defining as a strong town now?
That's a really good question. We've actually, and this is maybe falling back a little bit on my engineering bias, we've actually said, you know, we can measure what a strong town is, and we've came up with a few metrics. The most important one is a place that has the capacity to sustain itself over the long term financially. In other words, when you do a project, when you have a road or a street or a sewer pipe or a water tower or whatever, the tax base and the revenue streams that are associated with your community are sufficient enough to sustain that. One of the things that I found as an engineer very early on, and this is one of the things that perplexed me, is that we were doing these projects where you know, the cost would either get paid by the federal or state government, a developer would come in and pay the cost and then roll that over into people's home mortgages when they sold the properties. But it was looking at the costs that were associated and then looking at the tax revenues that the city was getting. And just doing simple math was realizing that the city was getting only a fraction of the money they needed in order to sustain all of this stuff. If you have a 100-foot lot in a city, you've got $50,000 worth of infrastructure in front of your house. If you have a house across the street, half of that is yours. That's $25,000. That means you should be paying at least $1,000 a year in taxes just to maintain the stuff in front of your house. That doesn't count your share of the water tower, the lift pumps, the treatment plant, you know, all of the other kind of common stuff. Well, nobody's paying anywhere near that in any of our cities.
So the cities are basically losing money.
Every transaction they do, they lose money. And that's the key understanding. The thing that goes with that, though, is that when the government comes in at the federal or state level, or when a developer comes in and invests money in the city and builds the infrastructure, for the city, the initial upfront costs are very nominal. But all of a sudden, they have all this growth and tax base. It creates what we call at Strong Towns the illusion of wealth. The city feels rich because they're getting money coming in. They don't have any obligations due for a generation. But when those obligations come due in a generation, there's no money to pay for them. We're now two generations into this approach. Literally every city around the country is financially insolvent if they put their balance sheet together because they've done 60 years of very, very unproductive growth, growth that gives you the illusion of wealth but ultimately costs you more than what you've gained cumulatively in revenue.
You say that you must have sufficient age diversity so that population will be added at a rate greater than the population is being lost. Now, we're here in Northeast Ohio. Cleveland was at one time an enormously large, productive, now, of course, Rust Belt city. And as all of the population has fled to the suburbs, even the suburbs are suffering right now. So I guess my question is, how are you going to get these people either to come back into the city and invest in it, or, you know, people are having fewer children? What's going to make a change back into strong towns?
I think that a change is happening whether we want it to or not.
Okay.
In the sense that, you know, when we're talking about the urban-suburban type of interrelationship, as in a Cleveland, what we're seeing in cities like that is that there's a natural migration taking place now anyway. The two core demographics that are in the home purchasing realm or in the people who are moving today are retirees and near retirees and millennials.
Right.
And both of those subsets of people do not want four-bedroom, three-car garage homes with large mortgages out in the suburbs and the exurbs. So there's a market kind of going on right now that is changing that. The other thing is that suburban life, when it was first kind of sold to us as Americans, was A, shiny and new. and B, supposed to provide all of this kind of freedom and flexibility that you didn't have in the old urban neighborhoods.
Like what?
Well, you had your own yard.
Well, true.
You could drive wherever you wanted to. You could, you know, you didn't have to wait for the streetcar line. You didn't have to walk. You could get in your car and go whenever you wanted to, wherever you wanted to. That promise or that kind of allure may have been real for a while, but it's not a situation we're able to sustain financially. You know, you've got congestion now. Because, you know, when we move everybody out, now all of a sudden everybody drives in and you've got all this congestion. So you can't just get in your car and drive wherever you want to, whenever you want to. Gas is $3.70 a gallon here in Minnesota. That's not a price point that allows you to, you know, live a life of luxury, where you can just drive wherever you want without any consequence. So, you know, the allure of this lifestyle is just simply not there, and there is a market shift responding to that right now. Now, the federal and state governments continue to subsidize the suburban development pattern, continue to subsidize automobile. You've got home mortgage interest deductions that subsidize single-family homes but don't do anything for rental properties or, you know, condominium-type units that people would live in more urban areas. So you still have the old system set up to perpetuate growth in this old model. Once that changes, which I think it will, there's going to be very little holding back. I think a reverse of what we called white flight for 2 decades, I think that you will see a reverse of people migrating back into urban areas.
I'm talking with Chuck Marone. He is the head of strongtowns.org. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Let's talk about what kind of changes we need to make to rebuild our towns, make them strong, when, you know, it comes down to money. We're building this super Walmart that was fought tooth and nail but passed anyway on the idea that, oh, new jobs. But really, going back into the city might create more jobs, yes?
This is what's fascinating, is that we have the value equation of how to create wealth and prosperity and jobs just completely backward.
Okay.
When you look at Walmart, you're looking at a place that employs a lot of people, has a lot of value, and pays a lot of tax. But you have to look at it as a city. You have to look at the total return on investment, because Walmart also costs a ton to serve. Walmart also takes up a lot of utilities, and Walmart also displaces a lot of your other businesses.
Right.
We've studied this around the country in places, and we'll go and we'll show a city, you know, you've got this Walmart, it's worth $10 million, it employs 400 people. Here's the neglected part of your city, the part of the city that you totally discount, the pawn shops, the liquor stores, the tattoo parlors, you know, the place that... They used to be the retail stores, but the retail's gone, and so now these kind of lower value uses have come in, and the city doesn't like them and despises them. But you start to analyze them and look, and on a per-foot tax basis, they're paying more taxes. The properties are actually worth more. They employ more people, and they have more individual small business owners. I like to explain it like this. If you look back through history at the way we built cities, we built them around people who walked. And the technology for doing that was not some grand theory about how we were going to get rich. It was not some intellectual pursuit about, you know, here's how we create growth and prosperity. It was literally a pattern and an approach to development that evolved by trial and error over thousands and thousands of years. You can look at ancient Rome, you can look at ancient Greece, you can go to the ancient cities of Asia, South America, North America, and they have a layout and design very similar to what we were building 100 years ago. Different materials, yes, but the idea that you would build a place around people who walked, there was a way to do that that was successful. These were places that created a lot of wealth and prosperity. They had to, otherwise they wouldn't have survived. What we have been doing the last 60 years is, you know, a huge experiment. It is some ideas based on some very intelligent people you know, Ebenezer Howard, Le Corbusier, the whole intellectual movement to rebuild cities around the automobile was done by very bright people. But that doesn't change the fact that it's never been done anywhere before. And we're living through this big social, cultural, financial experiment, and it's not going well. It's not working out the way everybody thought it would.
That is so true. Okay, we emphasize funding coming back to the local level.
Yeah.
How do you convince a town council or a mayor or even the citizens that investment of already what we would term now scarce dollars needs to be directed away from roads and bridges and people like Walmart, who, by the way, seem to get huge tax abatements when they move into a place?
Yeah, that's really the tragic part. The way you do it is you start talking about an actual return on investment. How much money do we spend versus how much do we get back? You could look at two companies and say, well, here's a company that makes $1 million sells $1 million worth of stuff a year. And here's another company that sells 100,000. Which one would you rather have as a city? Well, we'd rather have the one that sells $1 million, right? But what if the one that sells you $1 million costs you $2 million and the one that sells you 100,000 only costs you 50,000? Well, you'd much rather have the smaller one because you're making money, not losing money.
Right.
If cities actually did that analysis, what they would find is that doing things like adding bike lanes so that people have an option. If you can make it so a family doesn't have to have two cars, but can actually get by with one car and can bike and walk to places when they're not using their car, all of a sudden you've added literally $120,000 worth of purchasing power for them when they go to get a mortgage. Well, in a lot of our neighborhoods, and I don't know the Cleveland market real well, but I'm guessing that in Cleveland, you can get some houses for $120,000.
Oh, actually, so, you can get a heck of a nice house in Cleveland.
Yeah.
The housing market here, the stock is excellent.
So what we're talking about is not finding new money. We become so obsessed with new sources of revenue and how do we get new money to come in. What we're really talking about is displacing the money that we're literally throwing away today and putting it into more productive uses. If you're a city, would you rather have that $9,000 a year that the family spends on a car go for gas, oil, insurance, car payment, and all of these things that are outside of your city? Essentially, you're exporting these dollars. Or would you rather have it go into their mortgage, into their community, into a local business? We're not talking about finding new money. We're just talking about being smarter with the money that we have.
So, to wrap up what we've been talking about, do you see places where these changes are occurring, and do they give you encouragement for the future of strong towns?
Yes, but just brutally slow right now. we have immense capacity to delude ourselves, and we've had a really good run in this country. We've been able to, with the systems that we've set up, create an illusion of wealth for us that we've largely bought into. And so when things are trying to change, when the underlying economy is trying to transform into something else, and we come in and rescue it, whether it is through local subsidies for that new Walmart or whether it's a federal stimulus program that allows us to forestall any serious changes, it puts us back. We really need to get serious about evaluating our local economies, making them financially prudent and financially strong. And if we do that, it will change the emphasis from the low-return auto-based investments to the high-return walkable, bikeable, livable type investments that are going to make our communities financially viable.
So tell us a little bit about Strong Towns, and there are a lot of resources on your website that people could look to maybe go back to city councils or mayors or city managers and talk to them about some of these things. Tell us a little bit about Strong Towns itself, the website and the resources.
Strong Towns began as a blog, and I was really just writing to try to help myself figure some things out. And after a year, a friend of mine said, you got some really good stuff here. We should start a nonprofit. And I said, well, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have the time to do that stuff. a year and a half later, I'm running a nonprofit based on these ideas. We do a blog, we do a podcast, we have a TV channel. We really do a lot when it comes to communications to try to help just the ordinary citizen, the ordinary resident who wants to step up and take ownership of their community, give them an alternative narrative that they can discuss with their city council members, with their neighbors, with their business community. That's really what our focus has been. I've spent the last 2 years traveling around the country giving talks, meeting with neighborhood groups. We're entering this very interesting phase of our organization because we've evolved now a little bit beyond just the messaging, and we're actually starting to get into the community organization type of work. That's something that we've just started to dabble in. We've got a project here in my hometown that we've called a Better Brainerd. And I was actually out this morning at 5 a.m. With a chalker, one of the things that you chalk a baseline with
right.
on a baseball field.
Uh-huh.
We were putting in bike lanes on a street because we're doing a speed study. And you guys will be happy to know I got the results in. And when we put in bike lanes along this street and narrowed the lanes with chalk, we lowered the speed by 30%. It's right in a school zone. And these are the kind of things that we're piloting here that we're trying to export and teach other people around the country to be able to go out and do, and how to kind of make those really strong arguments for changes.
Well, I think you are in the right place at the right time, certainly from our perspective here at the Outspoken Cyclist and most of the people who listen and who are involved in bicycle and pedestrian advocacy. So I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me this afternoon. It's Chuck Marone. He's the head of strongtowns.org. And I'm going to keep watching what you're doing because I like it. Thanks.
Thank you so much. I really
All right.
appreciate it.
Have a great afternoon.
You too. Take care.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Chuck Marone joined me from his home, actually, in Plainfield, Minnesota. He was taking a little break and was at home with his daughters today. I really enjoyed our conversation. Very articulate. He actually has a TED Talk on the strongtowns.org website that you might be interested in. I love TED Talks. They're so much fun. So I hope you enjoyed this edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. Happy Labor Day to everybody. Stay safe. Go for a ride. Remember, next week we will be podcast only, beginning at 5:30 Eastern Time. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.